The commissioner of Scenicville would like to give an MVP award, gold star, thumbs up, kudos, accolade, whatever you call it, to the Golden State Warriors coach, Steve Kerr. As I'm recording this on the day in between the decisive game of the Stanley Cup Final and the potential decisive game of the NBA Final, because you know the Golden State Warriors can't blow a 3-1 lead in the NBA Finals twice. Well, stranger things have happened, right? But Steve Kerr last week, I mean, obviously the Warriors keep getting these legacy questions and greatest of all time questions, and I've honestly found it to be a tiresome, nonsensical debate about who is the greatest of all time in sports. And Steve Kerr just basically took an axe to it by trolling all the media that were there when he was asked, you know, about putting the 2017 Warriors, who at the time were undefeated in the playoffs, into some sort of historical context. And Steve Kerr was like, yeah, they're all right. They would all kill us. The game gets worse as time goes on. Players are less talented than they used to be. The guys in the 50s would have destroyed everybody. It's weird how human evolution goes in reverse in sports. Players get weaker, smaller, less skilled. I don't know. I can't explain it. Now, I will sort of touch on the Warriors against the 96 Chicago Bulls at some point down the line in this rant. But I thought it was beautiful just because, to me, the whole greatest of all time, or GOAT as it's acronymed, is just unknowable. And to me, there really is no such way of knowing. Obviously, health, human performance, the financial incentives to be great at sports keep getting better and better over time. But we're stuck in this sort of nonsense framing device where we keep having to debate it. There really is only who was the best, who dominated their era the most, given the conditions the sport was played under that maybe allowed for dominance. Because I know, like, one person, I saw one hockey commentator making an idiot of himself saying the Chicago Blackhawks weren't a dynasty after they won 3 Stanley Cups in 6 years in a salary cap league, for instance, back in 2015, because they didn't, you know, win 5 in a row like the Montreal Canadiens did when there were only 6 teams and there was no free agency and no entry draft. And obviously the greatest of all time thing got brought up earlier this year in the Super Bowl after the New England Patriots, you know, pulled off that comeback against the Atlanta Falcons with some brilliant coaching from Kyle Shanahan, Atlanta's offensive coordinator. And people are like, oh, Brady's got to be the greatest of all time. And you're like, no, you can put – he's not even the best passer of his own era. I mean, that would be Peyton Manning. Probably, if you happen to look up who had most wins as a starting quarterback with a defense rated in the bottom half of the league, 16th or lower, Peyton Manning had 102 in his career. Tom Brady has 20. Aaron Rodgers has more. Drew Brees has more. And consequently, both of them are probably better passers, and Brady's more of a system quarterback, but who happens to be married to a supermodel, but no one seems to ever want to expand the thumbnail out to that. So there we are. Like I said, there's only greatest of his time at his position when you're talking about individual players, and you can only really talk about people who define eras. If you want to put Sidney Crosby in historical context, I could say he represents this decade the way Wayne Gretzky, you know, looms over any discussion of hockey in the 1980s, or Bobby Orr in the 70s, Gordie Howe in the 50s and 60s. Mario Lemieux when he was healthy in the 1990s. Yeah, you could put him like right up there on a Mount Puckmore or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I thought the Steve Kerr quote was wonderful just because it just rolled the shit out of media who are, well, basically lazy and, you know, want to have really no rhyme or reason for how they come up with things and really aren't interested in, you know, helping people understand, you know, what was it about a sport in a particular era that maybe lent itself to teams winning, you know, multiple championships, you know, 4-5 in a row or 4 in 5 years. And then you can use that as a jumping off point to the debate. Is it better to have a team like that, or is it better to do what the NHL does these days, which is seemingly aspire to mediocrity, where any random team that has, you know, puck luck over a sustained period can end up winning the Stanley Cup, which is kind of what happened with the Penguins anyway when you think about the chances the Nashville Predators squandered and one that was taken away from them by a quick whistle by the official, and then the fact that Pittsburgh was able to score the decisive goal on a play from behind the goal line, which should never really happen, but there we are. People seem to leave that out when they talk about legacy. But anyways, yeah, greatest of all time debates need to go away. Go the way of the dodo. If you want to ask a more intelligent question with respect to basketball, to me, I think it has to be, well, who wins in a seven-game series, best-of-seven series, between the 1996 Chicago Bulls, so the Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, Dennis Rodman, Tony Kukoc, Ron Harper, Luke Longley, Bill Wennington. Hey, they had a Canadian on the team. Steve Kerr was on that team. He was kind of their floor-spacing shooter. Who wins in a series between them and the 2017 Warriors? Then, you know, if you want one control variable you could put on it as well, those Bulls had more regular season wins, so they would have home court for games 1, 2, 5, and 7 if necessary. The Warriors would have it for the other potential three games. You've applied the whole baseball home teams rules are used, so you'd be playing under 1996 rules when the Bulls were home in the United Center, and that would mean there would be hand checking. That would mean a lot less three-point shot. I mean, the NBA had just moved the line in, I think, in 1994 to try to stimulate offense, which it actually had the opposite effect for about 10 years until a generation of guys for whom the three was normalized sort of started to come into the league. And you'd probably have a more deliberate style of play. So, and then if you played in the 2017 game, you know, everyone would be jacked. Teams would be shooting 30 to 40 three-pointers a game. You wouldn't be playing with a center most of the time. The game would probably be a lot less physical and grinding. Who wins in that matchup? Like, to illustrate the difference in how frequently the three-pointer is shot, this year in the NBA, the team that took the fewest threes was the Minnesota Timberwolves. They took 1,724, 1,724. In 1996, that would have put them third in the league in three-point tries. Only one team that year attempted to put up more than 2,000 three-point shots. This year, 21 out of the 30 did. That's how much the three-pointer has become a greater part of the NBA game over time. But no one wants to talk about it. They're just like, oh, the Bulls did this, the Warriors did this. To me, if you have to put the 96 Bulls into a 2017 context, well, they were actually a pretty good outside shooting team. Putting the Bulls into that 2017 context, that year's Bulls team, they were third in the league in three-point percentage. You know, they had Steve Kerr. In a 2017 context, Tony Kukoc wouldn't be the sixth man coming off the bench. He would probably be playing sort of as a, you know, modern-day, you know, Paul Gasol, Dirk Nowitzki-type shooting forward role. You know, sort of Larry Bird was really the prototype for that back in the 80s, if you think about it. And those Bulls were also sixth in defending three-pointers. And you have to think, you know, they were playing a lot of games where they were playing with the lead and they really weren't probably coming out and challenging on guys. If you put the Bulls into that context of the modern game, I think they would adapt better to it than the Warriors would adapt if you had to drop them into 1996 conditions where, like I said, that you could, you know, put hands on an opposing player when he was dribbling. Obviously, Steph Curry wouldn't get that 5 or 6 seconds. Now, you know, you can imagine how peak Kevin Durant would do if he had to deal with Scottie Pippen guarding him out on the perimeter at times, and then when he went inside, he'd have to deal with Dennis Rodman. And the Warriors would obviously, you know, have to fight through a lot more contact. I mean, that was a period where, sort of in the wake of the Pistons, the NBA sort of did allow for a much more physical game. You think of those New York Knicks teams and guys like Charles Oakley and Derek Harper and Anthony Mason. There's nobody like them in the league anymore. They've gone the way of the enforcer in hockey, really, or the Canadian quarterback in football. Not really quite like that, but you get the sense of what I'm talking about. I mean, when you do these, you know, dumbed down GOT things, you're just losing sight of how the sport evolved. When you start to talk about, get down into specifics about what that team did at that time that made them successful, what it takes to be successful now, what are the trends, you know, who you could put in the, you know, the opposite context. I think that's where you help people really understand the sport better. And it's just sort of dismaying that that's not a priority in the media. That's, you know, something, you know, in my failed sports writing career that I think I tried to do sometimes, and it's just not a thing. but overall, that's why I love that Steve Kerr just took on the media about that. And I'm sure most of them probably just, you know, made for a great soundbite or whatever, but how many of them sat there and said, maybe, you know, maybe he's got a point when we ask these questions. He's not just being defensive. He's not just deflecting. He's not just trying to not jinx a championship by openly talking about the legacy before you win. I mean, obviously obviously that probably was an element of that. I mean, nobody wants to be, you know, the 2007 Patriots talking about an undefeated, you know, openly acknowledging an undefeated season, and then look what happens in a one-game showdown for the Super Bowl. They still did go 18-1, but it just happened that the one was at the very end. Now, my other great takeaway from the last week or so with these two championship series. You know, again, I don't want to do a lot of game analysis, but in terms of a sports person basically telling the media, be better, was LeBron James after game three of the finals, which obviously came down to the last few minutes. The decisive moment came in the final seconds. LeBron James, you know, did the draw and kick, drove into the teeth of the Warriors defense to free up a short corner three. The highest percentage shot in basketball, by the way, is that pocket three from the corner to Kyle Korver, who's one of the greatest three-point shooters in league history. Unfortunately, you know, Korver had a good look. It was short, came off the rim. The Warriors went down, and Kevin Durant quickly took a three, and it went. And that, I think, ultimately helped the Warriors win by 5 points. In a game where the line was 3.5, so that good decision by LeBron that didn't pay off, and that good decision by Durant, which paid off for the Warriors, made a difference for a lot of the betting community, but that's neither here nor there. So LeBron James gets asked, and I'm harking back 15 years to the former CBC producer I had at King's College, Bruce Wark, used to say, "No talking reporter ever had a good interview." And this is like an actual question from a media person. It goes on. "Obviously, you're no stranger to criticism, right? There are some people who feel with 50 seconds left in the game, you guys up by two, they would like to see you kind of force more in those moments to try to score that basket yourself as opposed to dishing it away. I'm just curious to know what your message to those critics would be." Like, what an asshole. Like, that's not... This person is not asking that question for those critics. That person's asking the question because he's trying to get a reaction out of LeBron James. Like, just be honest, okay? You're basically saying, well, you know, what the fuck were you thinking there when you passed to your open teammate in a team sport? Just drives me nuts. And LeBron James just kind of goes, "I don't know if you've been here for the last couple of years or heard me talk. I don't even really care. I had 101 drives last night. I didn't have 101, but you get the gist of it. I'm sorry I didn't go for 102. But at the end of the day, I don't really... What is a critic? It doesn't matter. One of my favorite quotes, when I really stop caring about what people say, is Theodore Roosevelt, the man in the arena. So if you read that, you'll see where I'm at right now in my life. It doesn't matter to me." And obviously that's the... famed essay by Teddy Roosevelt, you know, early 20th century American president, that, you know, the credit belongs to the man who is in the arena struggling valiantly. That's the crux of it. And I mean, the fact that LeBron James would just bring that up, the essay of you know, dead historical figure from more than a century ago, you know, shows me, you know, how self-aware and how, you know, much more engaging basketball people are generally than hockey people, who would just do the "you didn't play." I mean, he is kind of giving the guy the "you didn't play," but he's sort of putting a bit more of a high quality gloss on it. So hopefully I don't know how many other people there are in the sports liking world who would have seen those two quotes and maybe used it as a prod to think about how these games are broken down and discussed and disseminated, and how sometimes we can all be dumber for having to listen to it. But I'm glad that they're out there and they're taking the time to patiently tell people, you know, ask better questions or think about, you know, what the unintended consequences when you say, oh, here's the 10 greatest teams of all time. Because let's face it, none of us really know. We weren't there. And half the time, I mean, we don't even, you leave it up to people, they don't even get it right. What, you know, with a dynasty, who was their best team? I mean, NHL.com did that greatest NHL team of all time poll, and people picked the 1985 Oilers, who scored fewer goals, had fewer wins, and fewer points than the 1984 team. So I'm not quite sure how that worked out. And that 84 team also went 1-5 when Wayne Gretzky was out for six games at one point. So they might have actually challenged the single season win record that was held by the 77 Canadians at the time. So like I say, there's only greatest of their time, greatest of their at their position of their time. Let's just please keep it on that. So I do have a couple other things I do want to touch on before I wrap this up. Obviously, I always try to give a book recommendation, either something I'm rereading or something I read recently. And right now, my recommendation, you know, Father's Day is this week, and obviously since 90% of North American males can't talk to their dad about anything except sports, my book recommendation is Jason Turbo's. It came out in March. It's called Dynastic, Bombastic, Fantastic, Reggie Rolle, Catfish, and Charlie Finley's Swingin' A's. It's on Kindle. It's out in hardcover. Out in audio book as well. And it's obviously, for those of you who are baseball fans, it's a sort of a history of the 1972 through 74 Oakland A's teams that won three consecutive World Series. I believe still the only franchise other than the Yankees to go back to back to back. But it's much more than a book that's about a team that happened to be a dynasty. They came along at, I think, a very interesting time. I think, obviously, for the sports and entertainment industry. I'm sure people are sort of vaguely aware of their story. I mean, you hear Reggie Jackson, you think, okay, well, you know that Reggie Jackson would later go on to the Yankees as a free agent and win more World Series there. You think, you know, Catfish Hunter, part of his legacy was that he was made a free agent because Charlie Finley breached his contract, and Catfish Hunter and the MLB Players Association, you know, Marvin Miller and Dick Morris, they went to the wall and said, no, you can't do that, and Catfish Hunter was able to go to the Yankees too as well. But, I mean, it's such an interesting book because these were guys who, in that generation of pro athletes, they were relatively sophisticated people compared to maybe the guys who had, you know, grown up, you know, when America was a much more rural and, you know, poorer country. You know, you think of the generation of guys who were from immigrant families or guys who had grown up, you know, on farms like Mickey Mantle did. They were sort of guys who were aware and sort of knew that they had value, but they were also, you know, from an era when, you know, players were still, you still had to fight the owner to get a $2,000 annual raise. And yet by the end of their careers, they had these, you know, seven-figure contracts thanks to winning free agency. Like, Charlie Finley was such a cheap owner. I mean, and Jason Turbo, thankfully, you know, he gets guys who were at ease of telling their story. Finley was such a cheap owner, he tried to make the players pay for the postage on their own fan mail. Like, and the guys had to fight him at every step of the way. Like, he gave them rings for their second World Series because he was upset at them. They didn't have an actual jewel in them. They just had glass. And, you know, so players really had to go to town and really, you know, put their foot down over how they were being treated. And that was something that was constantly there throughout their whole run. In the way, you know, Finley ran the operation, it wasn't up to standard. So I just think that would be a great book to give your dad, because you sort of think of everything going on in the world right now where, you know, there's all these, you know, media forces trying to get people to resent anyone having anything, it seems like, so you don't focus on how the 1% or how the 20% are getting everything. You just have, and then, of course, people are always resentful. Oh, look at how athletes are overpaid. Well, here's what it was like within the last 50 years. I mean, where you could just be at the whim of an employer who decides to be petty and say, oh, you guys are going to have to pay for your own fan mail. Like, there was at one point where one player in 1974, one of the A's, he basically was like, I want to take extra batting practice. And they were like, well, you know, one coach was tasked with keeping a strict accounting of how many baseballs were lost in batting practice. And they're like, no, you can't take extra batting practice. And Alvin Dark was the A's manager for their third World Series win in 1974. And he was this straight out racist. I mean, I'm not saying he didn't have good qualities. He's, I think, on the short list of managers who actually won pennants in each league, because he also managed the San Francisco Giants to one in 1962 before he was fired for questioning the intelligence of African American and Latin players during an interview. And then he hooked on with the A's and sort of won. They won in 1974, but this is like the typical of the attitude that he had was something. Reggie Jackson had been serving a stint as the designated hitter because he had, a leg injury that didn't allow him to take his place in right field. And Sal Bando, the third baseman and kind of the emotional and spiritual leader of the team, was ready to come back and wanted to DH. And Reggie Jackson's kind of like, well, and Dirk, for some reason, puts his foot down and goes, no, you're not coming back until you're healthy enough to go in at third base. And Jackson says, well, you know, I can go back to right field. And Dark's like, no, you can't, and it became this thing. And then Dark tells Jackson, he goes, look, he says to Jackson, and at this point, Reggie Jackson's 27 years old. He's not a kid. And Dark's like, well, black boys heal faster than white boys. Maybe I'm not explaining it, but, like, that was the kind of attitude. I mean, you can't have that sort of thing in a professional sports environment. I mean, it does happen, but that's the kind of thing that progress and, you know, athletes speaking up for their rights, that's the kind of thing that people have know better than to tolerate anymore. And Reggie Jackson was kind of like, I'm hurt by what he said, but he didn't go all full dudgeon and go to the media and try to get Dark fired. He was just kind of like, oh, I'm hurt by what he said, but I don't think he realizes it's hurtful. I mean, it was a sort of a nuanced reaction. So yeah, definitely dynastic, bombastic, fantastic. Got a nice bright green cover because the A's were sort of famous at the time for being one of the first teams to sort of really be fashion forward with breaking away from the traditional white at home, gray on the road baseball uniform template. That's definitely something you should look at. Nice summer read if you got a father who was following sports in that era. Anyway, that's sort of about it for this Commissioner of Cynicville. I'll try to keep this up every a couple of times a week throughout the summer. I'm just doing it for myself. I don't really care if anyone listens. But take care, and remember, sports is just the toy department.